Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Hour two, it is 106. And Phil Rocco from Marquette.
Hello.
Also, I guess originally from Pennsylvania,
yes.
As we just learned.
Yeah.
I don't think you have that strong of a Pennsylvanian accent.
I can go into it, you know, if you want me to.
If that's a Pennsylvanian accent?
Get going down here, you know. Yeah, that's...
You sound like Smee from Hook.
No, that's... I wish that were not an accurate depiction, but...
Is that... That's the Pittsburgh accent?
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, my God.
It sounds almost like British.
I know. Doesn't
like
it?
Cockney.
It's a strange... I think there's a Scots-Irish derivation.
What is the... Like the hair, like, is it Dutch?
Scots-Irish.
Scots-Irish, okay.
Primarily, and then it's just like isolated, you know, Pittsburgh surrounded by hills. It doesn't, it holds on.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Do it again?
You know. I'm sitting here with Kristen Bry. We're over in Waukesha. Yeah.
Oh, it's funny because I think the way I promoted this show was, can academics be funny? And I think we've unequivocally said yes.
But I mean, I feel like that's a very conditional. It's like, you know, put me in the right environments, you know, maybe, you know, as I increasingly make out of touch jokes, I think, in class, like my students no longer have the cultural references for my jokes. And I think
I know, because
like,
you probably walk in and be like, he's a young professor. And then you talk about Saved by the Bell and they're like, what?
Yeah. You know, so I don't know.
All right. Well, I think the first time I even knew who I knew of your existence in the Milwaukee area was you wrote a guest piece for our mutual friend Dan Schaefer,
right,
and his weekly column, The Recombobulation Area. And you wrote an excellent piece on it called Who's Cream City? And it was talking about election turnout in nonpartisan municipal / local elections, because we had seen for the first time in so long a competitive primary for mayor. And then, you know, arguably the first time we had no incumbent in like running for mayor. And you thought that maybe there'd be this like big turnout of people excited to choose a new leader for the city. And
it was like 30% turnout. Right.
And, you know, and people talked about the weather, you know, because it's the middle of winter and it's whatever. They had all these different reasons. But you did a deep dive into kind of the historical significance, because we used to be a city that really turned out. And in fact, a lot of places used to really turn out. And so if you want to just summarize it, because I thought it was fascinating.
No, I have to thank Dan, because I don't think that there was a single other outlet that wanted to publish like a 2,000-word piece on the history of Milwaukee elections. But he let me really chew the scenery on it, which was fun. This is my sort of spring break project. I instead of going anywhere nice, I graded papers and went to the Milwaukee Public Library and went into the city's archives, which is where a lot of them are at the Milwaukee Public Library. Shout out to the awesome librarians there. And I was just going back and I was like, okay, I have these sort of conventional explanations for why people don't turn out in local elections. Like, one is this, I think, sort of nascent one, which is like, well, local politics is just boring, right? And then maybe it's more boring because the state has taken so many functions from the city. Like, we're not allowed to raise the minimum wage. We're not allowed to do a lot of regulation of, like, landlords. We're not allowed to have any sort of regulation of, like, workplace safety. Like, that's all. The state has preempted it, and so people don't. Local elections, just not sexy.
It's also nonpartisan,
enough, right?
So it's not like you have the red meat of those Dems or those Republicans.
And then, of course, like the off-cycle elections, which, you know, comparatively speaking, off-cycle elections, when you have them in the spring, it's less turnout typically than the fall. But going back, I realized like a lot of those things have been true for a long time in Milwaukee. Like, we've had spring elections since the beginning of the 20th century. You know, there's always been some level of state preemption. You know, we've had nonpartisan elections since, I think, 1912. You know, we've had a lot of the same sort of variables, same, like, setup, right? But back in, like, the early 20th century, it was routine that you had voter turnout, by which I mean people voting as a percentage of registered voters, because that's really you could say, okay, what about the percentage of voting age people? And that would just lower the turnout level like across time. But the main data that we have to compare is like voters as a percentage of registered voters. It was like 80%, north of 80% for like much of the early 20th century, right?
Which is insane even for any election.
It's insane for any election, especially a local election, right? And then I was like, okay, well, let's take a look at like who was voting. And I went and looked at like ward by ward in the city. Was it like the rich wards that were like carrying it? Poor. It's like, regardless of like home ownership levels, like income, people were voting at basically the same rate. So people who were in an economic class that today we would see much lower rates of turnout, much more because of economic disadvantage, they also turned out at pretty high rates. So I began thinking like, what was going on? And then you dig into this a little bit and you realize this isn't just a Milwaukee story. This is like a U.S. story, generally speaking. And then it's also sort of a global story. Turnout has declined in the U.S. at local elections since the 20th century. It's middle of the 20th century. It's declined. Done the same thing in other countries. So, like, what's going on?
So we're talking like this. What was the turning point? 60s?
The turning point is around the 60s, 70s, okay. Right? And you think about it, like, a lot about how you turn out and vote, it depends on, like, the context in which you're voting, right? And, like, I think the way that we treat voting today, it's pretty much like making a shopping decision. You know, you're like, okay, you read the facts and like maybe you compare the different like products, so to speak, and like you listen to some, you know, disembodied voices telling you things, and maybe if you're lucky somebody shows up at your door. Although I was canvassing recently, it's like if you live in an apartment building, it's really hard to canvass you. Yeah. But the way that politics worked in the early 20th century is it was much more community driven and less individualistic. So you had not political parties that were like these disembodied national organizations that maybe sometimes sent some people and money down to the local level. Political parties were like often local clubs. They were organized at the ward level. So you could be a member of a party club at the ward level, and the club would do stuff, right? They would have parties. They would have fairs. They would have events, sometimes soccer, you know, or whatever. And
soccer,
or what, I don't know, you know, baseball, who knows? In Europe, soccer is still big.
That makes more sense because we're talking about the Lambeau
Field. Baseball, I think, probably here. And so they were a huge part of your life. And so it was, and they also sent you mailers frequently, and they were, you know, communicating with people a lot. And so if you look at the way that people would have voted, they would have voted in this like very social context, in part because parties were guiding them to do that. And, you know, one of the things parties would do is like on election day, they could go to the poll books and see like, okay, who's turned out yet? All right, this person hasn't turned out. Like, we can go get them to the polls. So it was a very community oriented kind of activity. And like, so one thing that happened over the course of the 20th century is that local political parties just fell apart.
So when you say local political parties, that's not just Republican and Democrat.
So in Milwaukee, you had the Socialist Party was huge. In Wisconsin, generally, you had the Progressive Party. These are two big parties. And obviously, there's the classic Wayne's World speech from Alice Cooper about the, many decades of socialist mayors in Milwaukee. There were political clubs that you could actually be a member of. And the interesting thing is like everyday people could become a member, vote for the people, you know, to lead the organization and eventually become leaders themselves. So there was this like path, very clear path. Now that exists in sporadic ways now, but it was really much more congealed in the early 20th century. So you had these ways of like organizing people to get out the vote and engaging people. The other thing that you had at the same time was you had large union membership. Like union density in Wisconsin was once very high. Unions were really pivotal, not just on the shop floor and bargaining with employers. Obviously, if you've been to South Shore Park in Milwaukee, you can see the history of the eight-hour day. But they were also important in the political arena, and they communicated with their members about voting. And so those two things taken together, if you look around the world, that's the two things that have really changed. Like unionization has fallen throughout the world. In Wisconsin, it cratered, you know, even before Act 10, it was decreasing because of deindustrialization. But then Act 10, Wisconsin saw the largest union decline of any state from 2000 to the middle of the 2010s. So that sort of also helped to, you know, crash of voting. But the other thing is like where political parties were concerned, parties to some extent, stop being able to manage the demands of electorates. So what happened in Milwaukee in the 50s? You saw the final leg of the Great Migration, the first time you see a larger black population in Milwaukee. And while you had a socialist mayor, Frank Zeidler, actually have a program around integration, especially housing, he was sort of kicked out of office. He didn't even run for the last term because of a sort of racist smear campaign against him. That's when you have Henry Meyer come in 1960. And at that point, Vell Phillips was the first member of Common Council to be a woman of color. I think the Democratic Party at that point wouldn't even operate a ward organization in her ward. You know, she essentially had to do a lot of the campaigning on her own. So it's like these parties were not necessarily designed to manage a changing ethno racial kind of a climate, which of course by the 1960s became very conflictual, and housing marches and so forth. So you really saw the decline of these party organizations. And nationally, after, you know, the McGovern-Fraser reforms of 1972, you really saw, you know, local parties playing a weaker role in national presidential politics. You started to see the emergence or greater spread of presidential primaries as a way of choosing candidates. So what happened as a consequence is parties, in a way, even though we still have local political parties in name, they don't play the same sort of organizational role. They're not the lifeblood of communities. They're not organized necessarily at the ward level. And so politics is, in a way, a much, especially at the local level, I think a much less present feature of people's lives. And I think that means that people might not be aware, not because they're, you know, not curious or not intelligent, but because it is really obscure. Local politics is really obscure. And if you don't have organizations trying to tell people what is going on in the city and what the stakes of the issues are, then it's harder for people to engage. And which is why, in part, when I go to canvass somebody and they open their door to me, I just have a tremendous respect, because it's like, okay, we're going to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Right? Which is really cool.
Man, well, this is a good setup, because when we come back, I'm going to rate your professorial skills that you just demonstrated for me. But actually, we're gonna talk about ratemyprofessor.com and maybe read a couple of your reviews.
I cannot believe we're going to do this.
All right, As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. All right, so, you know, I get a lot of feedback in my life because I put myself on the internet. I put myself on the radio. I have a TikTok where I put things out.
People give you feedback on the TikTok?
Well, people either like the video, they let me know if they don't like the video. But, you know, it's like I am actively out there.
So you have a thick skin.
Yes, sometimes. Every once in a while, someone really gets to me, and then I have to hold myself back from wanting to drag them on the internet. But you, I don't even know. This has been around at least since I was in school.
Yeah, me too.
But ratemyprofessor.com, which is exactly what it sounds like, where you literally as a student can go on. It's Yelp reviews for professors.
Does it have a good beat and can you dance to it? Yes.
And I certainly checked this before I signed up for classes. And sometimes you had to take the class and you didn't really have an option, so you just sucked it up and you're like, well, now I know a little bit more about this teacher. But you, have you checked it lately? Have you read your own?
I have, yeah. I try not to look at it. You know, it's like because it's a bad source of information. It's self-selected. You know, people either love it or hate it. They, you know, And so it's like, not a great representation of like what so if you give too much weight to it, I mean, I know people do.
Do you have colleagues who check it and are upset by some things?
You know, to be frank, like I think a lot of it can be a pretty misogynistic venue. I've seen misogyny on there all over the place. And so I think, I mean, in a way, it's like, okay, yeah, I don't really care about like the fact that it exists. Hey, if it helps some students, like, you know, get their frustrations out or whatever, like, it doesn't matter much to me. Although I do think it sort of like commodifies teaching a little bit. It's like, you know, 5 stars, like, you know, great service. But I think it is, but I mean, truly there is some real, there's real like misogyny. I mean, I think they try to clean it up a little bit too, but like, it's kind of, yeah. So there's that aspect of it.
There's that aspect to it. Well, way to make this less fun.
Sorry. No, I didn't mean to. No, you want to talk about, there's no chili pepper anymore, by the way. That doesn't exist. Thank God.
Yes. I forgot about the chili pepper.
Here's one thing. Here's one piece of information I don't want to think about ever.
The chili pepper, for people who don't remember,
very gross.
It was how hot, like actually like how sexually appealing the professor was on top of their,
so happy they removed
their actual rating of, you know, how good their teaching is. But you, out of 5 stars, have a 4.7. It's pretty high.
You have selection bias. I don't know.
You have 5. So it's 1 is awful, 2 is okay, 3 is good, 4 is great, 5 is awesome. Pretty standard, straightforward mm-hmm. scale you got there. And predominantly 5s and a couple 4s. No 3s, 2s, or 1s.
Okay.
And
I keep them entertained, I suppose.
You 100% would take again.
Yeah, you know, you got to give them something to come back for. I don't know. I do think it sort of comes, I mean, hopefully these things are like based on, you know, genuinely they learned something in my class.
Yeah. So there's quality, there's difficulty rating. So your difficulty rating is 3.4. So you could be harder, it sounds like.
I probably could be harder. Said no student of mine ever.
But so what classes are you teaching right now? Like, what's the name of your classes that kids could be taking?
So I typically teach like something called American Public Policy, which is, yeah, I know, sounds riveting. It is. I teach a class on the politics of numbers and talk a little bit about like official statistics and things like that, which is, students are like, you know, this is the only one available. And so I try to make sure that it's worth their while. It's pretty fun. It ends up being pretty fun. I teach a class on American politics, and I teach a class on like federalism, so relationships between state, local, federal governments, which is a lot about, you know, that. Well, the first hour was like a preview for that class. So
what is your, like, which ones are like freshman classes versus like
It's all pretty mixed. All right. I mean, the intro class is like a lot of freshmen. Sure. Yeah. It's, but it's fun. I mean, like typically if you teach anything local, students are always like, I can't believe that the county does that much stuff. It's very, easy to like surprise students about such things.
Cause what's the breakdown of Marquette? Like, how many kids, I know you probably don't know this off the top of your head, but how many are from Wisconsin versus out of state?
It is a pretty even split. Okay. I mean, I'm basing that, I don't know overall, but I know that in my classes, it tends to be, I would say most is like even split between Wisconsin and Illinois. And then you've got a small minority of people from other states.
Okay.
But it's a lot of Wisconsin, Illinois.
All right. Well, here we go. So Dr. Rocco is, all caps, amazing. If you ever have a chance to take any of his classes, do it, !! He engages students, cares about them, and loves his work. He also gives great writing feedback and offers chances to improve. He lectures a lot, which we already learned. Offers enough office hours if you want to discuss more with him. Readings are manageable and grades are fair. That's a really great.
That is it. No, it's, I think what that boils down to is good vibes.
Good vibes.
It's the vibification of education. But I will just say, I have a friend who, I won't mention his name, I won't mention where he is in the country, but he has, because I think he views Rate My Professor as kind of preposterous, he's like, I want you to go on there and give me a rating on my haircut and give me a rating on my earring. And so you'll often like read his Rate My Professors.
Wait, because he asks students
students to do this. And so they're like, 7 out of 10, decent earring, haircut, okay. So I should start doing that.
Does he have a stud or a hoop?
It's a stud, I think.
All right.
It's a stud. It looks good, I think. The ratings are fair. I tried to calibrate it on that basis. The ratings are fair.
I read them. I agree with most of them.
Most of them are agreeable. So, yeah, exactly.
No earring. I should tell the audience, since this is,
I
the
have
radio.
No earring. No visible.
And a decent haircut.
And no visible.
You have hair.
No visible tattoos. wearing long sleeves at the moment.
Was that important to you?
No. No. It's, you know, it's, I, you can't see them. I'm wearing long sleeves.
Has that shifted in professor, like professor
I think
culture?
So. I think it's more, I think it's far more common now. It used to be the case like, oh, you can't, in no way.
I think
way,
it's the case for everything, right?
Yeah, it's the case for everything.
You're and never now, gonna get and now a job it's just like, if you have a tattoo.
I don't know if the perspective is just like, well, the world is falling apart, so you can have a tattoo. You know, cats can have a little salami as a treat.
All right, well, we got to take another break. I know exactly what tweet you're talking about. I love it. All right. Well, we're going to get your professorial political science point of view on the primaries that are less than 2 weeks away. Come back after the break. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bray. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. So, we got some elections coming up.
Yes, some primaries, August 9th.
We got some primaries.
Where will you be? I will be behind a elections table.
Registering people to vote or checking people in.
Yeah, checking people in.
I will be...
giving people a sticker. That's always fun. The stickers don't stick. If you bring tape, you know, because the stickers could be stickier. I'm just going to say that. I think they could be stickier.
What was I just listening to that there was a, I think I was listening to Love It or Leave It, and there was some county that's did a.
Oh, the sticker contest?
The sticker
with a
contest.
Weird spider
and now there's
thing?
A weird spider that's going to be on the the voting. Like that as a civic engagement opportunity.
Yeah,
like
it probably works.
Design the get out the vote sticker.
Yes.
This year, like I voted sticker this year, yeah. And take submissions from fifth graders.
Yeah, the state will probably ban that. They're probably going to ban stickers soon. I'm thinking, you know, that could be a thing that they do.
Ban the stickers. Ban the ballot boxes.
It's just like, well, just now we're really worried about these
you're
stickers.
You're incentivizing the wrong people to vote by giving out those stickers. God. All right. Anyways, so we've talked about the primaries a fair amount on here. But interested to see if you have any interesting hot takes. I mean, I kind of, as we've seen this week, yesterday, Mr. Tom Nelson
dropped out.
And so not that he was, at least if you're following the polls, was polling super high to have known how much of a difference it was going to make.
But it still matters.
It still matters.
Presumably, this means more, he throwing his support behind Barnes means more votes for Barnes from the sort of progressive wing. I mean, I sort of see it as like Barnes having consolidated both some, I think, moderates within the party and progressives. I mean, the fact that he's, endorsed by somebody like House Whip Jim Clyburn, who's sort of famously sort of on the more moderate conservative wing of the Democratic Party, and from progressives, I think would suggest that there's some level of vote consolidation there.
Are you surprised he's gotten as many high profile endorsements this early?
It's interesting. I don't really have a great baseline for comparison because this is such a different primary.
Yeah.
But it would seem to suggest that there's some, like, one of the things that political scientists often look for is what people call the invisible primary, which is like parties consolidating their support behind a candidate who, like, this is the official candidate of the party, right? As one way of influencing voters' choices. And that, you know, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. This race is kind of interesting because it seems like, in terms of like the endorsement race, it's kind of split between Lazary and Barnes, right? Barnes.
Who's endorsed? I feel like Barnes has gotten some.
He has some major
Elizabeth
national.
Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders,
AOC.
Cory Booker.
But even like somebody like Clyburn, another kind of pretty important person in the party. Also, think about the sort of party organizational structure is pretty significant. You look at the state and local level, a number of state reps, you've got a number of municipal mayors as well. The thing that Lazary has going for him is he's sort of consolidated some support within Milwaukee County, which can be pretty significant in turnout. If you think about like the primary electorate, it's now sort of cliche to say, is like, it's a much different electorate than the statewide one, right? Mm-hmm. It's Dane County, it's Milwaukee County, it's some smaller municipalities that lean more Democratic. But it's, you know, if you look at Lasry's endorsements, it's, you know, the county executive in Milwaukee, the mayor of Milwaukee, a number of members of the Milwaukee Common Council, and then labor, which I see as the other sort of big organizational force. I mean, you know, it's, I guess, you can focus on something like the debate and like, were there fireworks in the debate or not? That kind of doesn't matter as much in a primary. What matters is the endorsements and actually who is out there getting people out to vote. And so I think it's interesting. You do see some divisions within sort of major labor organizations. A lot of unions in Milwaukee are for Lasry, and then some, I think, statewide organizations for Barnes. I'm probably missing a few details of that. So if you think I'm wrong, I probably am. I mean, but go to the websites and you can kind of see. I think it's fair to say that there's some division there. So, I mean, that's sort of where it seems to fall right now. And Nelson getting out of the race would seem to suggest that you're going to see maybe some more progressive consolidation behind Barnes, and maybe it, you know, this is sort of the tete-a-tete, I think, going into, you know, 2 weeks into the primary that we're going to see. Did I sound like a political prognosticator? Did I sound like a pundit there? You know, saying something with also saying nothing at all. You see why I don't do this?
I mean, you sound like basically every podcast I listen to on the regular, so it's great. So I guess thinking about. Yeah. So, do you think there's any chance that Sarah Gadlewski is basically? In your punditry, are you pretty confident in saying it's going to be either Lasry or Barnes on the Democratic ticket?
Yeah, I feel, you know. So, like, okay, what's Gadlewski's argument that that's not true? Is that there's still a lot of undecided voters. The last Marquette poll, you know, had 36% undecided, which I think was the largest, you know, choice there. You know, so it's plausible that there could be a kind of invisible groundswell of support. But I tend to think about it, you know, she has some endorsements. They're not as, you know, so Emily's List, I think, is one of the big endorsers. There's some other kind of movement-based organizations. She has some, I think, state officials, some local officials as well. That are kind of, you know, lining up behind Gadlewski. She obviously also won a statewide election for treasurer, which is not nothing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's worth thinking about the fact that she has some connection of the state. I tend to think that when it comes to the sort of operations level of like a primary, that, you know, again, anything is sort of possible, but the endorsements don't just mean like a name. It also means maybe some resources and support of like getting out votes, making some key phone calls, that sort of thing, which would, to me, you know, if I, you know, were to sort of game this out, I would think that you're going to see Lasry or Barnes on the ballot. But again, you know, anything is sort of possible. And
as Stephen Alacar said, shock the world.
Right. I do see a lot of Gadlewski signs, right? Just, you know, colloquially. And it, you know, it's possible that there's a, you know, kind of a late breaking, finish, right?
But
I mean, also, I mean, perhaps there's an endorsement I haven't thought about that's, you know, in the wings that might be really significant that I just haven't thought of that she could lock up. I tend to think that if something like that, a big, you know, endorsement or big kind of campaign event doesn't happen soon, the odds seem somewhat slimmer, which is sort of how I always felt about Tom Nelson's candidacy, which is like not consolidating a bunch of very, very prominent progressive candidates really early would ultimately create problems for him, like getting into the top three or top sort of tier of the of the race. That was always going to be difficult. So, you know, I think some people have sort of complained that this race has like less fireworks than, you know, if you look at something like the race between Connor Lamb and John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, like a lot of fireworks there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to one extent, that seems like a misapprehension of like the way that you get votes in Wisconsin. You don't necessarily get votes in a Democratic primary by, you know, rhetorical fireworks.
Owning someone, right?
It's a, you know, again, like the election is not just like making the arguments you know, on the campaign trail, it is also about the very like unglamorous work of just like racking up endorsements. Who can you, you know, who's going to knock for me today? Like, who's going to get my name out there? And if I had to guess based on that and the endorsements, I would think, you know, tend to think at this point, it's like, you've got a lot of strength there behind Barnes and Lazary.
So then when you see probably where the kind of chips are falling for the primary, does that differ to who you, with your background, think would, how that would stack up against actually running against Ron Johnson? Because I think there's a lot of people who obviously don't believe this, but there's a lot of people who just think it's hard to believe that Barnes would beat Ron Johnson in a statewide election.
Yeah, I mean, it's tight. It's tight on the matchup polls that Marquette does, but there's also a lot of undecideds in those polls,
which is crazy to me.
Well, right, but it's, but it sort of makes it, I think it's crazy to us because like we think about this stuff all the time, and that really isn't the way that most people engage with politics, and that is what it is.
I think it's mostly just because Ron Johnson is such a divisive character.
Sure,
so well, to, I think to people, not be decided.
Well, I think the thing is, I think people have made up their minds about him. I think there's, his undecideds are fairly low. If I recall correctly, I could be wrong about that. And if I am, you know,
I think it's down to 14% that still don't have enough information to have.
Okay. So that's higher than I thought it was. Never mind.
It's always higher than you think it would be for how long he's been in office and how many things he's said.
Yeah. And it's
time in office,
you know, but it's, I do sort of think it's, you think about who's undecideds are the lowest. It's always executive branch figures, right? It's always a president. Maybe even a governor would have lower undecideds than a senator. Senators sort of in a legislature, one advantage of that is if something bad happens, you can say it was, you know, those other people, you know. But he has made a number of statements that have gotten press that are like the sending the fake electors, the bunch of stuff about COVID.
I don't care if John's come to
Oshkosh. Right. It's, you would think... And maybe there's some like...
It's not the government's responsibility to take care of your kids.
Yes.
But we're going to make you have them.
Right. The, you know, you would think the undecideds would be lower, but it could just be that he has a very bland name. Ron Johnson is, you know, who knows? This is not political science what I'm doing here. But it's, you know, in thinking about why there might be more undecideds, that could be it. It's like, who is that? But in terms of like who could beat him, I mean, I think it's really hard to say. You know, it doesn't seem like any candidate has a special, you know,
advantage.
Gaps or advantage. You know, I think that it, a lot
about it just comes down to running a good campaign.
Right. And ultimately, like if Democrats are going to, you know, win, I think in November, they have got to place, you know, some emphasis on things like abortion is a huge aspect of it. Johnson's comments about that. I think they probably need to go on the offense on inflation. You know, Republicans have tried to like own that issue. Interestingly, it didn't really come up at the lieutenant governor or at the governor's thing, which I guess you could, you know, it makes some sense because inflation is a global phenomenon, but that is
that doesn't stop the
Ian
commercials trying
you
to blame know that Evers from, for
yes.
inflation.
The
speaking
biggest,
of which, what do you have thoughts on that? Because we have 3 minutes left, but do you have thoughts on the strength or weaknesses of the gubernatorial candidates?
I think Evers is going to be able to localize the race.
Interesting.
I think he's going to be able to make this really about, you know, what's going on in Wisconsin. I think he'll be able to make it about issues of abortion. I think his candidates are extreme enough on some of these issues that I think he'll be able to use that to his advantage, which is why I think in the national sort of projections, the projections for the race sort of lean Democratic at that point to the extent that people want to take stock in them. That could change, obviously, in the fall. I think it's obvious, it's certainly close. I think he has some advantages as a governor. I think his approval rating has always hovered above. He's always bested the party's approval rating. He's always bested Biden's. And I think that people have a sense of him as somehow distinct. That will be the main thing, especially among independents, treating him as a different kind of political entity And the race is distinctive from the national race, I think might matter a lot. If it's a wave election and it's just, you know, Republicans doing what Republicans, you know, would do at a midterm where Democrats control Congress and the White House, I think there are more problems there. But I think Evers might be more capable of localizing the race.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't, by the way, don't like to do projections. Not when you know, it's like I've studiously avoided studying things in my career where that is an ask, because it is so easy to be wrong. And
we're not in the business of making predictions.
Yeah, I don't make predictions because in part it's like, you know, I've always seen politics as something that you study to give people a better sense of how to like go out and engage in it rather than predict it as if it's like the weather.
Yes.
You know?
Fair enough. All right. Well, we're going to take one more break. And then when we come back, there's a new meditation app that we want to talk
about.
Very
excited.
All right. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Fry. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. So I was raised Catholic.
So was I.
You were raised Catholic. You currently work at a Catholic university.
I do.
So maybe that's why we both got an ad for this.
Do you think that the algorithm knows that we're
I don't know if it's because we were raised Catholic. I don't know if it's because we're currently in Wisconsin. But
I also gave the algorithm a lot to work with. Once I saw what we're about to talk about, I then went to many subsequent tweets because I became sort of obsessed with it. It struck me as very weird.
So, scrolling through Twitter and come across none other than former Green Bay Packer quarterback, Brett Favre.
Best retirement speech ever, by the way, Brett Favre. It's not that I can't play anymore. It's that I'm not sure that I want to, I think was his first retirement speech.
So, you know, Brett Favre, who has, isn't he currently in a battle with one of the states on
there's
like
some sort of scandal,
some kind of scandal,
some sort of grifting
like
scandal,
unemployment or disability.
Yeah, I don't know
checks
what he's
from the government
up to
or something.
Yeah.
So clearly, potentially, he has to. He has some bills to pay because he is the spokesperson for
one of them
new Catholic meditation app called Halo?
I don't know how it's
pronounced.
Do we
have Jane's
Halo?
Jane's gonna play the audio from this commercial. All right, so we're gonna play it for a second. So I'll set up at least while she's getting the audio ready. If anyone's ever gotten a Cameo, so Cameo is this app where, or like this service where you can get celebrities to talk into their phones and give, like, as a birthday present, you can, like, give your buddy, like, a message from Snooki.
Dawn Henley or something.
Yeah, you know, there's all these, celebrities, A, B, C, D list type celebrities who are on there. You can pay them a certain amount of money, and they will send a message to you. But it's, you know, it's largely someone just kind of riffing into their phone camera, and then they send it to you as a message. And so it kind of looks like that. Like, there is very little video production for this to be the...
He's clearly holding the phone. Brett Favre is holding the phone.
He's clearly not looking into where the camera is on your phone.
Like, it is really obvious that he has never used this app. It rocks.
And he's basically just talking about why... And it's not, there's nothing against the app. There's nothing against meditation. There's nothing against prayer and medication. This is not me making fun of him. It's just such a weird, in the pitch meeting for this app, we're like, all right, who could we get?
People love praying. And people love Brett Favre. And what if we put those two things together?
And it was jarring. I think that's the best word I have heard. All right, we got it.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. It's Brett Favre here. And I'd love to tell you about this life-changing prayer and meditation app called Halo. It's the number one Catholic app in the world and an amazing app for Christians looking to dive deeper into their prayer life, not just Catholics. It's been such a resource for myself as well as millions of others around the world to find God's peace, overcome obstacles and struggles, and quite frankly, just build a daily habit of prayer. So, hey, you got to check the app out and start praying with me on Halo today. Download it free today. God bless.
All right.
So, again,
Hello, everyone.
Oh, no, we got it again.
So this is not to disparage praying. This is not to disparage meditation.
This is a very weird commercial, though.
Think, like, you know, the message itself is very sincere. It's just very weird. Like, it's weird to see him just with a very close about his face talking about this as a ad on Twitter. And so, but you looked into it. You went a step further and talked to, like, learned more about this app.
So, yeah, I mean, my background here, grew up Catholic. My family prays at every meal. Prayer, you know, I think, you know, a great thing in many ways, right?
Part of your life.
Okay. This whole thing leaves me thinking, like, what stage of capitalism are we in? You know, it's just like, where, like, the, when does the, what stage of capitalism is prayer commodified? And, like, oh, to say,
I mean, first of all, wasn't it always commodified?
I mean,
have you been to the Vatican?
I was like, yes. So, like, this is like this, the strong Martin Luther vibes here. But also at the same time, you know, this is like, they advertise themselves as the number one Catholic app. What's the number two? Like, just going to church, I think. That was the number one for 2,000 years. You know, like, you could say that, like, you know, the, you know, there's the line that Jesus says that, where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in their midst. You could say that that was, like, the first social network site. Communion of Saints, that's very distributed. But the people who sort of came up with this, like, they are thinking about this as, like, a commoditizable prayer as being commoditizable. So, like, this venture capitalist, Catherine Boyle, put it in a 2020 piece for the Washington Post, quote, "A holy trinity is in place. Isolated people hungry for attachment, religions desperate for growth in an online world, and technology investors searching for the consumer niches yet to digitize." And it's like, you know, your grandfather's Catholicism, he had to go to church to pray. Now you've got the app. And it's like, well, okay, prayer and Catholicism, very different. Like, the whole point of prayer is community. This is an app which is mainly something that you use alone. And they say, like, well, you can, like, network with other people on it. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but it's kind of, you know, it's a little strange. And then the other thing is, I think Peter Thiel might be one of the big funders for the app. Okay. Some sort of nefarious creatures.
Do you think Peter Thiel spends a lot of time praying?
You know, for what? I shudder to think. God knows. But there's another thing that things sort of scandalize this, which is, like, they're actually harvesting the data and commodifying the user data. So I don't know, like, what might you be searching for before you pray? Maybe, you know, very tough things in your life. That data, I think, by these sorts of sites. Now, they're saying that they're not using it for anything nefarious, but, like, they're hoovering it up, evidently, and making money from it, which is maybe the most sacrilegious thing I've ever heard about in my life. That's like money changers in the temple sort of thing. And it's just like, no, it's appification. It's like, look, the church was always an app. You know, if you want to like really reduce it to those things, it's like a set of practices, whatever. But the truly wonderful thing about this is just the utterly alien and just otherworldly performances given by people like Brett Favre. I think there's a Mark Wahlberg one as well.
Wow. Now I gotta go on the hunt to see which ones I can find. All right. Well, we got 1 minute left. So where can people find you and all your humorous takes and on politics and Wisconsin radio
the commercials? The cave where I live. No. So I'm on Twitter at Philip Rocco, 1L, R-O-C-C-O, in there. God, that felt terrible to say.
No, you want to try it again?
No. People can find me there. You know. Yeah,
all right.
Generally haunt the internet. Pretty
haunting
pretty
of the internet.
Easy to find for better or worse, I guess.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you back here.
All right.
And people can find you here again. But
yes.
That'll do it for today's Taco Tuesday. No Choco Taco Tuesday. We'll be back tomorrow. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.